On behalf of the Walter H. Capp Center at UCSB, it's my pleasure to welcome you to tonight's Martin E. Marty Lecture on Religion in American Life for 2006-2007. Our distinguished guest speaker is George Regas, whose talk is entitled A Spiritual Progressive Encounters the War Machine in America. I'm Ann Taves, Virgil Cordano Professor of Catholic Studies in the Department of Religious Studies at UCSB. Since Wade Clark Roof, the director of the CAP Center, is on sabbatical leave in Paris, yes, he's having a very rough time of it, it's my pleasure to introduce tonight's event. Indeed, it's a particular pleasure as a former student of Martin Marty and a frequent one-time visitor at All Saints Church during my 20 years teaching in Claremont. So I have attachments to all of the principals tonight. The Martin E. Marty Lectureship was established in 2005 in honor of the eminent scholar, teacher, and commentator who taught at the University of Chicago Divinity School and who has authored over 50 books. Martin Marty is an ideal embodiment of what the CAP Center has as its mission to broaden the base of public conversation about important issues beyond the walls of academia. The inaugural lecture was delivered in 2005 by Marty himself, who spoke on mapping American spiritualities. And the second lecture given last year was presented by Peter Steinfeld's columnist for the New York Times, who discussed the secular, the religious, and the demands of citizenship. Tonight, we're honored to hear from the Reverend Dr. George F. Regas, Rector Emeritus of All Saints Episcopal Church in Pasadena, one of the largest Episcopal churches in the United States. All Saints is one of the most dynamic and culturally diverse congregations and was highly active under the leadership of Regas in its opposition to the Vietnam War, the escalating nuclear arms race, the covert Central America wars, and both the Gulf Wars I and II. During his 28 years of service with the church, Regas established the largest AIDS service center in the San Gabriel Valley, took the lead in performing blessings of union for same-sex couples, supervised the creation of the Young and Healthy program, which serves uninsured and underinsured children, and established the homeless shelter Union Station. In 1998, he also founded the Regas Institute. The institute is dedicated to the study and examination of progressive religion and seeks to counter the dominance of the religious right. No introduction of George Regas would be complete without also mentioning that All States Church is currently under investigation by the Internal Revenue Service. This in reaction to a sermon, an anti-war sermon, which Regas returned to the church to deliver under the tenure of his successor in October of 2004, just 2 days before the presidential election. This ongoing and, as you probably know, highly controversial investigation has placed All Saints at the center of a national debate on politics from the pulpit. So please join me in welcoming George Regas.
Wonderful to see so many people here. I know the place is full, but unfortunately, I do not see one face. So if you get a little sad, I won't see it. If you get a little happy, I won't see it. But I have the feeling that you are my supporters. I'm really honored to be here tonight to give the Martin Marty lecture. Dr. Marty is such a prolific writer whom I have admired over the years. And Walter Capps spoke a couple of times while I was at All Saints Church, and his wife Lois has continued admirably the Cap progressive witness in the House of Representatives. And so I thank you very much for having me here tonight. I'm very honored. It's a great privilege. And I'm most grateful for Anne's very generous introduction. It does remind me of a story. One day a speaker was introduced to his audience with these words, "Listen to this speaker, he is a very gifted person, as is evidenced by the fact that he made $1 million in California oil, so listen to him." Well, the speaker responded with thanks, but he was a little embarrassed and confused. Some facts were there, but they were very misinterpreted. He said, first, it wasn't oil, it was coal. Second, it wasn't California, but Pennsylvania. Third, it wasn't $1 million, but 100,000. Fourth, it wasn't me, but my brother. And fifth, he didn't make it, he lost it. But facts aside, I'm glad to be here. Well, I am George Regas, and I don't know much about making $1 million, but I do know something about peacemaking. So I'm happy that we are together. It seems like almost everyone knows that I preached that sermon on the Sunday before the presidential election in 2004. It was titled, "If Jesus Debated President Bush and Senator Kerry." That sermon got me into a lot of trouble with the tax collectors, and it certainly got All Saints into lots of trouble. In it, I took great care to say that I was not telling people how to vote, but I was challenging them to go into the voting booth on Tuesday, taking with them all they knew about Jesus the peacemaker. And were the IRS to disappear from the face of the earth, it would still be wrong, it seems to me, and unhealthy for religious institutions to endorse candidates. There are theological, constitutional, and practical reasons for this. Good people of profound faith were for George Bush, and good people of profound faith were for John Kerry. And for many, their vote was deeply rooted in their faith commitment. And so it's foolish to speak and act as if God is in the pocket of the Democrat or the Republican parties. No one attended that sermon from the IRS, to my knowledge. There was a newspaper report in the LA Times the next day that described my sermon as a blazing indictment of the Bush administration's war policies in Iraq. And the news report said that I had also been critical of the administration's drive to cut taxes that benefited the rich, which I described as inimical to the values of Jesus. And based on this, the IRS went to work, got copies of the sermon, and made a subjective determination that the sermon implicitly opposed one candidate and endorsed another. During my almost three decades as the rector of All Saints Church in Pasadena, I often preached sermons that touched upon what would be characterized as political issues. So many of the political issues that we confront today coincide with core religious beliefs: health care, marriage and family, immigration, human rights, national security, and war, just to name a few. And it seems to me that fundamental moral issues are indisputably the province of religious institutions and their pulpits. An IRS investigation will not diminish the prophetic ministry of All Saints Church. Peace, alleviation of poverty, sexual justice, human rights, the care of the environment are core values of that congregation. And if we were to allow the IRS to silence us, we would lose our integrity, the very soul of the ministry. I'm confident that All Saints will not allow that to happen. And after responding cooperatively to several earlier IRS requests for extensive information, the rector, Ed Bacon, received two summons mid-September 2006. One called for a lengthy list of documents. The other required his appearance at an IRS hearing October 11. And after much study and legal discussion and prayerful deliberation, the Vestry of All Saints Church voted unanimously not to respond to those summons. All Saints legal counsel Mark Owens, from a very distinguished law firm in Washington, D.C., informed the IRS, "We believe the only way to challenge the IRS's actions in this case is through a summons enforcement proceeding in federal court, and therefore the church respectfully declines to respond to the summons. Reverend Bacon will not appear to testify on October 11, 2006. All Saints took that position because they had fully respected the IRS regulations against campaigning intervention by unwaveringly adhering to the guidelines against endorsing political candidates. However, they were defending the religious responsibility to criticize public policy that violates the sacredness of life. And now our case hangs midair, and we await the next action." There's a story about a preacher trying to get serious with her congregation and to speak about the imminence of death and its power over us. Her opening sentence was that in 100 years, every member of this church will be dead. And with that, a man on the fourth row began to laugh. Now, there's nothing more upsetting to the preacher than to have somebody miss the mood and in the intent, so she thought the brother had misheard her, and so she said again, "I'm here to say that in 100 years every member of this church will be dead," and the man laughed again. The preacher began to get a little angry, and she turned to the laughing man and she said, "You think it's funny?" "Yes, I do." "Well, why do you think it's funny?" "Because I'm not a member of this church." Well, I'm here tonight to say that the church I want to belong to is one that has given primacy to the peacemaking ministry and that is willing to risk boldly for the sake of Jesus, the peacemaker, and for the sake of the well-being of the whole human family. I believe passionately that the Christian church must be in the vanguard of peacemakers in this broken, war-fractured world. To be the world's primary peacemakers, that's the bold mission for the church and other faith communities in the 21st century. Religious communities must stop blessing war. They must stop blessing violence. Followers of Jesus, the Prince of Peace, must be first and foremost peace advocates, always protesting the misuse of military power to settle political problems and challenging our blindness to the poverty and despair that make for revolution. I am sure Some will call me naive, but this is what I believe is the truest reality in the universe. Mercy brings mercy, and revenge brings revenge. Tragically, the world refuses to learn this truth after so many bitter experiences in every part of the world. Gandhi was right. If we all live by an eye for an eye, the whole world will be blind. The IRS does not appear to understand that believing Christians and Buddhists and Hindus, believing Muslims, believing Jews, are presented with a peacemaking mandate, and that seeking reconciliation and renouncing the unlimited violence inherent in an unending war on terror is not just one option among many. And so there is no hyperbole at All Saints. It's for real that the assertion that the issue for the parish at this time is indeed the free exercise of religion that is supposed to be guaranteed by the First Amendment. Many people around this nation share this peacemaking imperative. They are signifying to us that they grasp completely the stakes involved when a free pulpit in America is challenged by the enormous power of the federal government. There is a story about this minister trying to teach the congregation about one of the great stories in the Bible. So he placed a lion and a lamb in a cage right outside the front door of the church. A lion and a lamb living together. And people from miles around came to see this unusual phenomenon. And finally, the governor of the state heard about the deal, and he was so intrigued by this remarkable feat that he sent a delegation to see how this clergy person pulled off such a trick. "Oh, it is no trick at all," said the clergyman. "All you have to do is to put in a fresh lamb from time to time." Preacher, in the real world, lions and lambs do not live together peacefully. How many times that's been shoved into my face? And Woody Allen says, "The lion and the lamb lie down together, but the lamb won't get much sleep." That's the rub. Well, I have been a priest for 50 years, trying to face up to the truth of this real world of brutality and fear and suspicion and the need for security with all of its complexity. And yet not lose hope, not give up the dream of that world where nation will not lift up sword against nation, nor will they learn war anymore. It's been a ministry searching for what is real and authentic, and attempting to explode the myths and illusions that have taken us to the rim of disaster. Let's move on. Central to my progressive faith is the strong belief that mixing politics and religion is a holy task. Now, some people would say I was very political in my ministry of 3 decades at All Saints Church. But all life is political. Jesus sent his apostles out to heal the sick, and caring for the sick is a primary responsibility of a priest. Today, just saying the words health care plunges us into a political maelstrom. In the midst of all of that, I have tried to remember that I was ordained a priest to speak truth to power. And I'm a firm believer in the separation of church and state. However, the separation of church and state does not require banishing moral and religious values from the public square. America's social fabric depends on such values and vision to shape our politics, a dependence the founders of this nation recognized. I proclaim as strongly as I possibly can that mixing religion and politics is a holy task. However, politicalization of religion, as we see in some evangelical fundamentalist churches today, unequivocally endorsing one candidate, is very unhealthy. It is possible and necessary to express one's faith and convictions about public policy while still respecting the pluralism of American democracy. Rather than suggesting that we not talk about God and politics, I say progressives should be arguing on moral, ethical, religious grounds that all Americans should have economic security, health care, and educational opportunities. True religious faith results in a compassionate concern for those on the margins of our society. So joining our deep religious faith to the politics of ending poverty and social despair is a holy task. George W. Bush is the most overtly religious person ever in the presidency. He was saved from his excessive drinking by the ministry of Billy Graham and calls himself a born-again Christian. It is said that President Bush doesn't give a speech without placing himself under the protection and guidance of God. Jesus is his favorite philosopher because Jesus changed George Bush's life. When the reporter Bob Woodward asked President Bush if he had consulted with his father before ordering our army into Iraq, President George W. said, "No, he's not the father you call on a decision like that. I talked to my heavenly Father above." President Bush has often justified the war in Iraq by asserting America has been the instrument of God's will. President Bush has said that God told him to strike Al-Qaeda and at Saddam Hussein, and frequently says God's hand directs the affairs of this nation. In my opinion, such talk is nonsense. That kind of talk, echoed by so much of the religious right, distorts authentic religion. And yet today's political progressives are still reluctant to say their religious and moral values help shape their political views and their positions on state and national policies. For many progressive, politically progressives, faith and religion are private and have no implications in political life. What would America be today if Martin Luther King Jr. had kept his faith to himself? When I say mixing religion and politics is a holy task, I'm not referring to the particular religiosity of a candidate or even how devout he or she may be. That is less important than how their religious, moral, ethical commitments and values shape their political vision and their policy commitments. During the days of the Watergate scandal, President Nixon spoke again and again about personal morality. The president's men tried to uncover the immoral behavior of congressional people on Nixon's enemies list. They wanted to know how much they drank and with whom they slept. What distorted virtue and integrity? Those sleeping in proper beds would almost destroy a system of government. Vietnam, Watergate, the Contra scandal. Maybe all the predominant actors in those sordid stories in American political life slept in the right beds. But their concept of morality and virtue were grossly warped. They focused on personal morality and ignored those corporate evils that rob and hurt and oppress and kill human beings. Poverty is a religious issue. The gap between the rich and the poor is greater than it has been in 50 years. The poor are getting poorer. The health care crisis is getting worse. The income of typical households is stagnating. The average weekly wages have fallen, and the safety net for the unemployed and the casualties of the American system has been seriously eviscerated. And in the midst of all of that, President Bush asks and gets income tax reductions where 50% of the tax savings goes to the top 1% of the wealthiest Americans, averaging $1,200,000 of income each year. And many now in Washington, both Democrats and Republicans, seek to make these tax breaks permanent. All of that would break the heart of God. For one ordained in the Christian church to preach God's word, my challenge to all of this is not class warfare. It is at the very heart of the Jewish, Islamic, Christian faith. However, prophetic religion has not boldly challenged this. The religious right has drowned everyone else out. Now the faith of Jesus has become known as pro-rich, pro-war, and pro-American. And over the past few years, as we witness the growing concentration of wealth and privilege in our country, prophetic religion has lost its voice, drowned out by the corporate, political, and religious right who hijacked Jesus. Jesus has been hijacked and turned into the guardian of privilege rather than the champion of the dispossessed. Nothing is more abhorrent to God, the God of the Abrahamic faiths, than trampling the poor. Some smirk when we say it's the economy, stupid. But I continue to say poverty must be central to every political campaign. And the failure of political leaders to help uplift those in poverty here and around the world will be judged a moral failure. Yes, poverty is a religious issue. How we deal with the obscene gap between rich and poor, how we deal with the increasing powers of corporations, how we collaborate with impoverished nations of the world in their effort to be free and healthy and equal players in the global markets, these are profoundly religious issues. This leads me to a third concern. Any religious institution that seeks integrity must preserve the freedom of the pulpit, and academia must treasure the rights of critical inquiry. There are many who believe the IRS claim against All Saints Church was, in fact, the government's effort to silence the church's sharp judgment against the Bush war in Iraq. To give up the right to speak truth to power would be the loss of integrity. Before I retired, I used the text for my final sermon, the closing words of Dr. King's famous I Have a Dream speech. Free at last, thank God Almighty I'm free at last. Well, that person didn't know much about my work. I had the freest pulpit in the world As one called by God to lead the people, I demanded a free pulpit if I were to do the work faithfully. And then I tried to keep the pulpit free by using it as a place my understanding of God's truth is proclaimed. For instance, I was free to talk about the scandalous neglect and disregard of children in America. The first priority of any civilization is the care of its children, to prevent needless suffering in the ranks of the vulnerable and the blameless ones, and to give them wholeness of life. In a profound sense, the ultimate test of a moral society is the kind of world it creates for its children. And what we have allowed to happen to children in America and around the world is unconscionable to a moral people and breaks the heart of God. 1/5 of our children grow up poor, 1/3 grow up ignorant, and vast numbers are afflicted with poor health, and this in the richest nation in the history of the world. It is an astounding, numbing statistic that 40% of those who live in poverty are children. Any nation whose poorest citizens are its children loses every claim to greatness. Well, the pulpit at All Saints has been free to call into searching judgment the Democrats and the Republicans and those citizens who have supported national policies that hurt and destroy children. Many politicians today in Sacramento and Washington still seek to balance the budgets on the backs of children. Any public policy that hurts children, that weakens families, that refuses to heal babies and educate youth is morally outrageous. We don't need reduced taxes and decimated programs for children and youth. We need nothing less than a Marshall Plan to save our children. The pulpit must be free to make that proclamation. I want now to move and take a deeper, more critical look at the war in Iraq. But before that, there is a wonderful story warning us all against pretentiously giving the last word on any subject. One night at sea, the ship's captain saw what looked like the lights of another ship headed right at him. He had his signal person blink to the other ship, "Change your course 10 degrees south." The reply came back, "Change your course 10 degrees north." The ship's captain answered, "I am a captain, change your course south." The reply came, "I am a seaman, first class, change your course north." This infuriated the captain, so he signaled back, "Damn it, I say change your course south, I'm in a battleship." To which the reply came back, "I say change your course north, I'm in a lighthouse." With that caution, I proceed on the war in Iraq. The Iraq war is unjust, immoral, and illegal. It violates the deepest moral teaching of every major religion throughout the world. We've gone to war against Iraq with all its terror to make America safer, and the world weeps. When President Bush led us into war, he said he would do all in his power to protect innocent people. Yes, yes, we must have that as our goal, but it is simply impossible. We know that modern war is total war. And that's the reason Pope Paul, John Paul II, and now Pope Benedict XVI called the war on Iraq immoral and unjust. This is why it is almost the universal conviction of religious leaders outside the evangelical fundamentalists that this is not a just war. Yes, President Bush had the religious right blessing his desire for war. However, from every direction, strong messages were being sent to President Bush that this preemptive war against Iraq does not have the support of churches and mosques and temples throughout America. This war is not a just war. Our God does not bless this war. In World War I, 5% of the casualties and deaths were civilians. In World War II, it was 50% of the deaths and casualties were civilians. In the Vietnam War, it was 90%. And no one today dares to say the civilian casualties in Iraq will be any less. Now, a leading British medical journal, Lancet, indicates the Iraq War has killed at least 650,000 Iraqis. The horror of that. No matter what President Bush says about trying to protect innocent people, I want to proclaim as loudly as I can that war, with the face it wears today, is sin itself. The evil at the heart of this war against Iraq is the sin of American exceptionalism. By that I mean, it is the belief that an American life is of more value than an Iraqi life, that an American child is more precious than an Iraqi baby. Therefore, a reaffirmation of our common humanity and our membership in the human family and our equality in joy and in pain must be given primacy if there's ever to be peace. I want to move to a deeper level. At the grave, we are all equal. And the suffering of one is not more important than the suffering of another. This reality is tragically missing from the American psyche. I can hardly bear looking at those pictures of the women and children in Iraq caught between the deadly fire of American soldiers and Iraqi insurgents. We have simply destroyed that country, the cradle of civilization. Very clearly, modern war is total war. With the lethality of modern weapons, there can be no discrimination between combatants and civilians. And looking at all that, I think Jesus would bless Howard Zinn when he says there is no flag large enough to cover the shame of killing innocent people. The horror of war that kills the children and their mothers. I hate war for that. 4 years ago, my daughter Michelle died suddenly and unexpectedly. The pain of that is beyond description. Her death made no sense. My heart has been numb, my days bleak, the reality of that loss excruciating. But I think of all those children in Iraq killed as a result of our war, and 50% of Iraq is children. I think of the children across the globe every day that die of malnutrition and hunger, the death of one child every 3 seconds. And my heart can hardly bear it. At the grave, we are equal. How such suffering and loss must break the heart of God, for no one deserves it. And the big lie back of all killing, where the street gang murders, deaths in Israel or Gaza, war in Iran or Iraq, exterminations at Buchenwald, prisoners on death row, or the highly efficient deaths from nuclear bombs. The big lie back of them all is that the victim deserved to die. But to people of conscience, to people rooted in the moral values of our Jewish, Islamic, Christian heritage and other faith commitments, all life is precious. We know that when life is cheap anywhere, it becomes cheap everywhere. I want no allegiance less embracing than the whole human family, and I know that in the nuclear age, the smallest unit of survival is the whole world. We mourn the death of 3,000 people killed on 9/11/2001. But it is troublesome that we in America could get so caught up in our own tragedy without ever mourning the death and destruction and loss of so many in other parts of the world. We can find our unity as together we try to heal some of the pain that lies upon the world. The reaffirmation of the sacredness of all life, our common humanity, our equality in joy and in pain must be given primacy if there's ever to be an end to war. A story is told of President Lincoln following the Battle of Shiloh. He was approached by the frantic brother and sister of General Lew Wallace. They had heard the general had been killed in the Battle of Shiloh, but President Lincoln assured them that he had not. He was alive. It was not their Lew Wallace who had been killed. The people sighed with relief and turned to leave. But the president responded with the compassion that so marked and distinguished his whole life. Oh, but it was somebody's Lew Wallace. Have we lost that compassion? Where do we go from here? Let me say where I stand on the present crisis before Congress and the White House. I believe we should end the U.S. occupation of Iraq, and at the very latest, by the end of 2008, all United States troops must be out and all U.S. bases closed. There is anguish over what we're doing in Iraq, but also there is anguish in what we're doing to ourselves. It is just as patriotic to keep your country from dying as it is to die for your country. The moral imperative is stopping the U.S. occupation in Iraq. Begin the troop withdrawal now. Complete it by the end of 2008. That is a bipartisan position. Republican Senator Chuck Hagel speaks for a growing number when he said, "The surge escalation policy of President Bush represents the most dangerous foreign policy blunder in this country since Vietnam." But people say to me, "How do you propose we end the U.S. occupation without creating greater chaos?" When that is said to me, I remember a story about Robert McAfee Brown and William Sloan Coffin and a group of outraged citizens who managed to secure an appointment with Henry Kissinger at the height of the United States' involvement in Southeast Asia in the late 1960s. as the conversation got heated and citizens were asking for the withdrawal of our American troops, Dr. Kissinger, one of the chief architects and proponents of the Vietnam policy, challenged them on the complexities of such a withdrawal and asked rhetorically, maybe rhetorically, how would you get our boys out of Vietnam? Bill Coffin, then the chaplain at Yale University, you know he was not going to let this opportunity slip by. Rhetorical or not, he responded in Coffin style, Dr. Kissinger, our job is to proclaim with Amos that justice must roll down like waters and righteousness like a mighty stream. Your job is to work out the details of the irrigation system. ...3,200 American soldiers dead, tens of thousands wounded, many for life, who struggle here in this country for some help. And scholars now saying the Iraq war will end up costing more than $2 trillion. And also there have been 56,000 divorces of soldiers who have been in Iraq, and the estimate it will reach 100,000 broken marriages and devastated homes. There are huge corporate and financial interests in America's presence and its staying in Iraq. The oil reserves. There are reasons for us to stay there. And the political pressure, the corporate influence will be enormous for us to stay in Iraq. And the moral imperative is to end the U.S. occupation of Iraq and close the U.S. bases, leave the country with the second largest oil reserve in the world to make their way as the U.S. provides the financial funds for the Iraqis to begin the reconstruction of a country that we have literally destroyed. I want to close this lecture with a warning and a signal of hope. Remember, there is such a thing as being too late. Will we learn about the perils of revenge and violence and war soon enough to act and change our ways? Will we learn before it is too late? Of all Michelangelo's powerful figures, none is more poignant than the man in the Last Judgment being dragged down to hell by demons, his hand over one eye, and in the other eye, a look of dire recognition. He understood, but all too late. Michelangelo was right. Hell is truth seen too late. And today I call out to you to join the movement for peace before it is too late. People are sick to death of the insidious distortions of truth, sick to death of self-righteous confusion, of raw military power with pure, beautiful moral strength, sick to death of this nation's willingness to destroy Iraq, once the cradle of civilization, in order to save it, sick to death of America's duplicity in saying, we want to bring democracy to Iraq when we are there to establish our powerful presence in the second largest oil-producing country in the world. We need to end the occupation and fund the reconstruction of a shattered nation. Join the peace movement somewhere, somehow, before it's too late. Virtually every meaningful social transformation in the history of the United States has resulted from nonviolent movements that have mobilized grassroots people power. The people's movement to ban landmines had it right. Judy Williams had this to say when she accepted the Nobel Peace Prize for her work to ban landmines. Together we are a superpower. It is a new definition of superpower. It's not one of us, it's all of us. I believe that. All of us can somehow, some way, fuel a new movement to free the world of nuclear weapons, to bring justice to the poor, and to end the ways of war and destruction, and see peace reign across the globe. So hold on to hope. Cynicism and despair are the death blows to this movement. Good people will do nothing if they have lost hope. Hope is the engine of change. Teilhard de Chardin said, "The world of tomorrow belongs to those who gave it its greatest hope." My dear sisters and brothers, don't give up. Don't give up. It's not too late yet. The Spirit of God calls you and calls me to save this wonderful, wonderful creation. The great Creator God needs you, needs me, and calls us to share in this mission of transforming the world from the place of violence and war into that beautiful kingdom of peace. What a privilege. What a privilege. Thank you.